body.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Our guest today is Mel Nichols, Team GB Paralympic cyclist, endurance wheelchair racer and adventurer. Just 15 months after taking up wheelchair racing, she was at London 2012, representing Team GB before going on to do the same in Rio. Last year, she nailed the London Marathon in under 2 hours and also broke the world record for hand cycling the whole length of Britain. She's battled strokes, heart surgery, extreme weather and plenty of bad planning for wheelchair access in airports to travel the world, finding the adventure in absolutely everything. Mel Nichols is on the Big Travel Podcast.
My name is Mel Nichols and I'm a Paralympian, wheelchair racer and hand cyclist and ultra endurance cyclist.
We're here in Greenwich in the Ibis Hotel in your very tidy room, actually. I'm quite impressed.
Yeah.
You were packing to go.
I was, ready to go, yeah.
And you've just completed a half marathon.
Mm-hmm.
In your, is it a specially adapted chair, I'm guessing?
It's wheelchair racing, yeah, so it's a racing wheelchair.
Mm-hmm. With your hands?
Yes.
Yes. And I think with you, it's a temptation to jump about in time, but I want to start most recently because mm-hmm. I've spent this morning watching your beautiful film called Dream Big, mm-hmm. and it's about your 2019 adventure of a world record breaking adventure, as it turned out, mm-hmm. hand cycling the length of Britain. The film was just incredible. It's showing at the Four Seasons Film Festival, screening on Monday the 16th of March, and it's just a fantastic film of your what looks like an incredible journey. Why don't we start with that journey?
Great, thank you. Right, where do you want to start?
Well, how was it? Oh gosh, so you're setting off from Land's End, which looked grim, and that was like the first 5 minutes. You had me almost in tears because I can see you've got tears in your eyes when you're setting off through, I'm guessing, nerves, excitement, emotion. How are you feeling?
Well, it was kind of 9-10 months of building this project. You know, I had this idea, I had this plan, but that was as far as I got. So I had to build everything around it. I had to make it happen. So I say it had been 9-10 months. Actually, it had been 11 years. You know, it had been since my last stroke. So this whole journey had got to this point. So the morning of setting off, the night before, I couldn't sleep at all. My body was just, you know, sort of on edge and sitting on that start line, and yeah, the weather was grim. We were waiting for it to get light. It never did get light. So I just wanted to get going, and everything was going through my head. Mainly, I think I just wanted to hide away from the world, because although I'd had this great idea and I'd built this plan, it had got massive, and all of a sudden I was like, who do I think I am that I can do this? How can I break a world record? You know, cycle 9 days. It's never been done before. And I just kind of wanted to get in the sea and, you know, thought no one's going to notice. But actually, as soon as I set off, as soon as, you know, the countdown went and the clock started, I was just cycling. That's what I do.
So what's the route? It's over 800 miles, is it?
Yeah, just under 900 miles. Uh-huh. You can basically choose whatever route you want as long as you start at, so you can go either way, as long as you start at the signpost and you finish obviously at the other signpost. And as soon as the clock starts for the Guinness World Record, then it'll keep going no matter what, whether sleep, stopping, start, whatever, until you reach the end point, the signpost. So yeah, you can choose your route. Obviously you could choose, for me it was about choosing the fastest, the sort of flattest, which was the main roads. It wasn't the most scenic route. You know, you could go maybe a more coastal route or perhaps on smaller roads, but for me it was about It was about performance. It was about breaking a world record.
At one point on the film, you get stuck on the M6 and almost arrested. That looks quite hairy.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the M6. It was, I think it was the A74M.
But it was a road that you definitely should not
be on. Yeah, apparently. Yeah, ones with M on the ends of motorways.
I don't know why they don't spell that out.
Exactly. Put an M at the beginning. Exactly. Make it more clearer.
And you almost got arrested. And this lovely scene, you seem to win over the police.
Yeah, it took a while. And they were fantastic. You know, they were just looking after us. They wanted to get us safe, and thankfully they did. I'm so, so grateful to them. It was actually the second sort of potential police incident of the trip. I think there were three in total. Definitely the closest call. And yeah, it was kind of obviously when we got it called in, they stopped us. And actually it was thankful to my charities that I was raising money for that we got let off. I was getting done for dangerous cycling, and the drivers were getting done for dangerous driving, because obviously you're not allowed to be on the motorway. We didn't mean to. It was a complete accident. But thankfully, they saw the what we were trying to do, the good with it. So
you lie very flat on the bike, don't you? And to me, that, I mean, I look at cyclists who are sitting up on a bike, and to me they look vulnerable.
Yeah.
But lying flat on a bike, flat on your back almost, you're very, very low in the road. Do you feel vulnerable? Because I'm guessing you are vulnerable to traffic.
Well, I guess I could say, well, if somebody hit a standard cyclist, it's going to hurt, isn't it? So they're vulnerable, I'm vulnerable. If you're a horse rider, you're vulnerable. If you're a walker, you're a runner, you know, a mum with children, you're all vulnerable, aren't you? Yes, I am, but so is everybody else. And as far as I'm concerned, it's not about us not using the roads. As long as we're all sensible and we're, you know, sharing the road, it's about everybody being aware and being respectful. I won't stop. You know, it's what I do. I train, I cycle on the roads. Yeah, it definitely can be scary. You've got to do everything you can to keep yourself safe.
Before we give away the end, because spoiler alert, you do break the world record. What was the best bit about the journey? As a travel experience, what was the best bit from the travel point of view?
There were loads of best bits. There really were. I think the best bit, which perhaps I expected, was the fact that I was riding my bike every day. You know, it's something I do anyway, but I wasn't having to sort of start at home, do a loop and come round. I was doing on a journey, and that feeling of being on a journey is fantastic. So you get up and you're on your bike and you just keep riding forwards, and then, you know, you stop at the end of the day and you do it again. And it's so simple, that kind of simple notion of adventure or whatever it is on a journey. It's just wonderful. I think perhaps the unexpected, as I said, I went the main road, so the most direct route. It was big roads, dual carriageways, going through sort of the big cities, and I didn't expect it to be very scenic. But you know, it was. There was magic. There was nature sort of everywhere, in the little roundabouts, in the cities, or even on the dual carriageways. Like, so the wild verges with wildflowers, and I could see the bees and the, you know, little wildlife and stuff. And it was magical. It really was. Because even though I'm racing, I'm you know, going as fast as I can, I'm still on a bike. I'm not in a car. I haven't got, you know, this box around me, so I can just take it all in. And
that's,
it was incredible.
Isn't it? When you're in a car, you're so boxed off.
Yeah.
I feel that. I don't drive. Well, I don't drive a lot myself, and try to, you know, take other forms of transport, mainly walking for me. So to just appreciate the journey and like being part of, because you don't feel like you're part of something. If you're,
not at all.
Especially if you've got the windows up and aircon on.
Exactly.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah. And for me, it was about, you know, a lot of my mental attitude, I suppose, was about being in the moment. And that was all part of it, you know. And when it did get tough, it's like, just look around, look where you are, look what you're doing, look what's all around you. It was incredible. Yeah.
I think your mental attitude has, you know, got a lot to do with the way you've thrived, you know, since your first stroke, which we'll talk about in a second. But tell us about the record. So how you smashed the record. You actually absolutely smashed it, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess I did.
The male and female record.
Yeah,
I say.
The female record stood at 10 days and 8 hours. The male, the Guinness had set, was 10 days. So I obviously planned for 9 days. You know, clearly it hadn't been done before, but I kind of had this idea that I knew I could ride 100 miles in a day. Therefore, although I'd never ridden 2 days of 100 miles, I thought, well, if I could do one day, I could do 2 days. And that's kind of how I did the journey, really. And that once I got over day one, I thought, well, I can do that again. Once I got over day two, I thought, well, I can do all of that again. So you kind of double it. So that was the plan. But actually, each day I was able to do more miles. I just felt good. I just wanted to push on, so I did. For many reasons, partly, you know, because it was always good to have that bank of hours if ever I needed it, if there was a mechanical or a navigation error, or, you know, the weather was horrific most of the journey, so there might have been a time that it was so bad I had to stop or I couldn't carry on. But also, yeah, if I have that sort of bank of hours, if I can sort of chip anything off. I think I knew the ninth day was the shorter day. Potentially, in the best scenario, I could just take a bit off and make it just 8 days and something. But yeah, came in at 6 days, 22 hours and 18 minutes.
Which is basically 4 days less than any other record, the male and female records. Absolutely amazing.
It was incredible.
That's the thing, though, about the weather. You know, if you attempted to do it somewhere else, like in the south of France or something.
Yeah, I'd like to do it again, maybe, with better weather. But you never know what you're going to get. And there's you know, maybe the fact it was such awful weather made me push harder. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get this over.
Yeah.
So let me take you back, before we talk about your other, your travels particularly, but let me take you back to, was it 2008 when you had your...
My last one.
Your last stroke. Mm-hmm. So what is, tell me the stroke history. What happened?
So I've had three major strokes. The first one, 2002, I think it was. And then another one the next year, and then quite a while afterwards. The first one, it was never obviously found the reason why. A lot of tests, a lot of kind of assumptions carried on. And there was actually quite a big gap until the most recent stroke. And when that had happened, thankfully, things were looked into a bit more and found that I had a heart defect, which was what was causing these strokes. So unfortunately, it was the last one. Although they'd all affected me and they'd all affected my left side, the previous two, I could still walk, I could still, I learnt to ski, I was running and all the rest of it. But it was the last one that took away my mobility and my balance and more kind of mobility side of stuff and physical stuff.
What mobility do you have?
So my left leg doesn't work, my left arm doesn't work very well, and I kind of have no balance, so I always fall to the right, which is very weird. So kind of both sides are affected in different ways. So my right leg, I still have use in my right arm, so I walk around in crutches or in my wheelchair sort of for further distances.
And you were watching the Beijing Paralympics when you got a jolt out of, well, it was almost like a booming voice saying, this is what I want to do. How did it
happen? Not really, to be honest. I spent a lot of time in hospital.
Yes. Yeah.
there's not a lot else to do other than watch TV. And it was, I remember the summer of sport, and that we had, it was one of the Wimbledons that just, Federer and Nadal matches that just went on, I think, for days, and I loved kind of watching the sport. And I've always been active. I wouldn't say particularly sporty, but, loved being outside, loved being active, loved being fit. And so I love watching the sport. And then, of course, the Olympics and the Paralympics came on, and I didn't really know anything about the Paralympics before then. It hadn't been on my radar. And it wasn't that I watched it and thought, I want to be a Paralympian at all, because I thought, for one, I was going to get better. I'd recovered from my previous strokes. I didn't know how long it was going to take, and I didn't know perhaps how much. I guess I assumed, well, I've been through this once. It's rubbish, but I'll just have to go through it again. But it was watching the guys at Paralympics. It was just the fact that whatever they, perhaps impairments or whatever they didn't have, that was not coming into it. It was their determination and their passion for sport and what they were doing. And it just made me think, well, rather than waiting until I am better, whatever that better is, what am I going to do now? So that's kind of the start, I suppose, of me just getting back active and getting fit again.
And just, was it only just 15 months later that you...
Not from there, yeah.
From
so
there.
I was in hospital a long time. I was at home. I had sort of carers 7 days a week. So it took a long time in the early days. I had heart surgery and stuff following that. Eventually, when I was slightly weller, then I had my carers, and that used to support me, taking me to various sports that were available that I found out about. And wheelchair racing was one of them. So that was in, I think it was the end of 2010 sort of time that I tried wheelchair racing. Only ever saw it as an alternative to my sort of nightly jogs. I used to love running. I was never very good at it, but it was kind of get home from work, put my earphones in, run through some puddles, feel better about the day. So I thought, well, I can't do that anymore, but if I've got a racing wheelchair, I can get in my chair and, whiz around the block. Never thought anything more of it than that. There was quite a social circle with that. I met my coach, and he was always very supportive, but great fun as well. So I'd go down to training just for the social side, really, and the fitness. And he obviously saw something in me, knew, had a bit more an idea, sort of kept doing it, kept competing, or started competing. And it was very speedy 15 months later, I got the call to say I'd been selected for Great Britain.
Just 15 months after starting wheelchair racing, you were in the GB Paralympic team.
Yeah.
And London 2012.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That makes me shiver. The whole London 2012 thing makes me shiver. You know, it was such a beautiful moment for
Absolutely.
Our country.
Yeah.
And also for Paralympics as well, because I think it really put... I certainly hadn't watched any Paralympics before, and
no.
I think that a lot of people you know, would say the same.
And definitely, suddenly, I felt that with, you know, it was only because it was on the TV when I was in hospital for Beijing, but you wouldn't know about it if it's not, yeah, it's not something, you haven't got people involved in it, then, but London really, really changed that.
So were you at that opening ceremony then, I'm assuming?
Do you know, I wasn't.
Because I was just about to ask you, what was it like? Because it was amazing. I was down the road. Well, where we are now, you know, we're only like a mile away.
Amazing. No, do you know what? I still haven't seen it.
Seriously?
No, because, so we weren't allowed to go, the GB team, because a lot of us had events quite soon. So although it's fantastic, and of course you want to soak up every single moment, you're there to do a job. So they didn't want us, you know, out there sitting,
enjoying
standing,
themselves.
Whatever. We're just kind of getting tired, you know. It's great, but of course it's energy that you need to be focusing on what you're there for. So, no, we had like a private party in GB House in Stratford. I think we were in bed by kind of 9 o'clock.
And what was it there? What was it like actually when you did get into the stadium to
perform? Oh, it was amazing.
Perform. I want to say perform. Did we say perform?
Kind of felt like it, to be honest. Yeah. I think I remember when I finished my first race, my heat, and I had an interview, and I don't remember saying it at the time, but I've read it since, and I'd said, I feel like a rock star. So, you know, it's kind of that feeling.
Yeah. And I was there for the last night, and I had quite an attachment to the Olympics because I had my first child after several miscarriages in July 2012. But in the run-up to that, I'd been filming a lot for corporate films and things in the stadium and watched it all grow. I'd interviewed and spent a day with Oscar Pistorius. He was a lovely man by all accounts at that point.
That's what I thought,
And he was lovely. And then at the very last day, I was there for the last day of athletics for the Paralympics. Mm-hmm. So the next day was the ceremony. I was there for a last day of sport. And in that stadium, it was just like, wow. And then, you know, Oscar did his thing. And that felt like the culmination of it all.
Yeah.
Obviously, it all went a bit wrong for, you know, him.
So I think that was probably the Thursday, wasn't it? The Thriller Thursday, they called it.
Was it?
Yeah, my heat was on that evening as
was
well.
Was it? Well, so I probably
incredible.
Saw you.
You probably did, yeah.
I was sitting in the audience with a 5-week-old baby, you know, and it was just with headphones on. He was crying all the way. I think I was crying all the way. Yeah. It was just so, it was overwhelming.
I was crying too.
I can't imagine what it would have been like to be there, you know, in everyone watching you.
It's strange. And I watch back sometimes if I see people play a bit of film or something at an event from there. And it's not just a memory, it's a feeling. It's amazing. And I'm actually getting it now when I talk about
it.
Like,
oh.
You had the torch in the stadium as well. And every time you're in the stadium, you can feel the heat from that torch. And it just, the smells, everything, just absolutely incredible. I kind of try and liken it again to being like maybe at a concert. It's not just listening to the music. There's that feeling, isn't there?
There's
but it's like 100 times more, you know, than that.
Incredible.
That,
electric, almost.
Yeah,
electrifying.
Really is, yeah.
If you go to the Museum of London, they've got the torches there. Remember the opening ceremony that you weren't at? It had the beautiful tulip torches that opened into a big flower, almost, and then they closed them at the end. And they've got those actual torches in a big room.
Oh, have they?
And they play footage of the opening and closing ceremonies on repeat. And honestly, it just gives me chills.
I was there so sad when they put that flame out on that.
I know, and that flame seemed to like go out for a lot of things for the UK after that. It feels like, you know, that was at such a high. It was such a high.
It really
wasn't
was,
it?
Wasn't it?
I'm not talking about much travel, but okay, so this is travel, and London is a place of travel. So after that, 4 years later, you went to Rio.
Yeah.
How was that?
Didn't go to plan, unfortunately. I wasn't on the British team before London. London was my first time I represented GB. It was my first championship event, you know, to actually start at the top was a bit crazy. But as soon as London had finished, I was on the British team, and day one was about Rio. So that next 4 years was everything was about Rio. That was my full-time job was to race. I was working at a school, so I left the school and it was just completely focused on my training. And it was fantastic. I mean, I hadn't ever done a 4-year cycle, an Olympic cycle, so I didn't know what that was going to be like. Actually, it goes really quickly.
I'm sure.
In between, we had European Championships, World Championships. I think I broke a world record 3 times on the track. So there's a lot going on. You're building up to that point. And I was in the shape of my life going into Rio. The previous year, I'd been at World Champs. I'd won a world silver medal. So I was going in a really great place. Unfortunately, as you would probably hear from some of the other stories, when I got into the Paralympic Village, then in about 3 days, I got very sick. So I was put in quarantine and got pulled at my race. So, yeah, really, really tough times.
We had a lovely girl called Charlie Webster on the podcast. Mm. I don't know if you know Charlie Webster.
No.
She's a presenter, sports presenter for Sky Sports. And she was over there reporting for Sky. And she got very ill. She was, she died when she was there. No, but she came, sorry, I'm really wording this badly. She died, but then was brought back to life.
Oh my goodness.
She, her mum said goodbye. She was flown over. And it turns out she had malaria. She'd cycled to Rio.
I do know.
Yeah, it's quite a prominent story. Yeah, she cycled to Rio. And somewhere in the north of Brazil, she got malaria. But they didn't work out until about 7 days after she was on life support. She literally died,
oh,
and her mum was brought over, said say goodbye.
Yeah.
And she had made me cry on the podcast. It's such an incredible story. And she's such a bit like you. She's, you know, a motivational speaker.
I remember the build-up to that ride. Yeah, it was really exciting to follow.
It was really exciting.
Yeah. Mm.
And then, she's just incredible. And she's had long-lasting physical effects from here. But she's out. She's running marathons.
She?
You know, she's just got to conserve her energy.
Yeah,
you guys should meet. She's very inspirational.
Oh, that's amazing.
So from a travel point of view, I mean, did you get to hang out Rio?
You know, and I think I didn't get a fair view of Rio for sure. I would like to go back. I love the adventure. So I'd love to be able to get out there with my bike and get in the hills. And I remember watching the Olympics.
Take your malaria tablet.
Yeah, definitely. And watching the Olympic cycling course, it looked proper gnarly, you know, but actually to get there and to just explore that would be amazing. The only thing, and actually when you are in the Paralympics or the Olympics, you wherever you are, but you're in this little bubble, you're in the village. And it was the same for London. Of course, it was incredible, but you wouldn't know you're in London because you're just in this village. You don't see anything else. And in Rio, we were in the village. And on the last day, I was feeling pretty rubbish, but I thought, well, it's over now anyway. And it was the marathon day. So I did jump in a taxi and I headed out to Copacabana Beach to watch the marathon come in. So I probably didn't get the best impression. You know, I'm very much of a kind of more of a wilderness person rather than the tourist trail.
So tell me about being a wilderness person. What does that involve? Where do you go? What do you do?
I love being outside. I love the kind of challenge of, for me, I think my adventure that I rediscovered was the time out when I wasn't racing on track. Then I'd try and push those barriers in another way. As an athlete, obviously we're trying to push barriers, we're trying to be better than we were yesterday and all the rest of it. But I still see that as quite a safe environment, especially on the track, you know, track versus the road. But when I'm out, kind of, I love to take myself to the Scottish Islands or over to France or even further away. It's just challenging myself, and I'm completely on my own. No one usually knows where I am. I'm faced with either a mountain I'm trying to get up or caves I'm trying to find, or whatever it is, and think, well, how am I going to work this out? How am I going to do this to find a way to get to these places? Or went off to the Faroe Islands, a challenge to get from island to island when they're connected through subsea tunnels of kind of 160 metres under the seabed and stuff. And think, well, somehow I've got to cycle through here.
You get through the tunnels on your bike?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're on your own?
Yeah.
How does that work?
pretty scary, pretty exhilarating. When I went over to the Faroe Islands, my challenge, and that was in 2018, was to hand cycle, solo hand cycle, as many of the islands as I could. They haven't all got roads. And I say they're linked either by the subsea tunnels or by boats or by helicopters. So it was a real challenge logistically, trying to even get from island to island. I was going to land on the first island. I had no idea how I was going to get to the next one. And that particular time, that tunnel that was linked, most people, that was the only way to get to the other island. So you've got all the big lorries, everybody is in this tunnel. Most people said, you know, you can't cycle through this tunnel. But there were a couple of people that said, yes, you can. So I thought, well, I will then. And I think it was fine. Oh, thankfully, yeah, made it no problem. But I didn't really think the fact that it was 5 miles long and it was 160 metres under the seabed, that I'd obviously have to go quite a lot down to get to it. And my bike was loaded up with about probably 30 kilos of stuff on the back as well, which on top of the weight of my bike makes it quite heavy, so it drops pretty fast. And I had set up on my bike, I was trying to be as off-grid as possible, so I had like a dynamo on my front wheel, and I had a unit that then charged all my USBs for all any electricals, and also my lights. But unfortunately, because I went so fast down this hill, it made the light explode halfway through the tunnel.
That's true. It could be really dangerous.
Like, yeah. Wearing I had a few of the lights, but it was more the fact that I had no lights. But there was a few yeah. kind of on the back.
That's dangerous too.
But yeah. So that was an interesting experience for sure.
And I'm also thinking that you have to go down. You then have to go up.
Oh, right? Yes.
That must
yes.
be hard work.
Yeah. I was really lucky. And that's something that really stood out on the Faroe Islands were the kindness of strangers. And somebody had came past me as I was probably sort of levelling out sort of halfway through the tunnel and asked me if I was okay. And I said, well, I am, but my lights just exploded. And they said, there's nothing I can do, but you're in this really, really busy carriageway. You know, nobody can pull over and stop. It's just not safe. So I said, well, if you could wait the other end, because I knew I had another tunnel to do, then that could be really helpful. So they did, which was great. But of course, I had to go 2.5 miles back up again, which took a long, long time. So this poor person was waiting probably a good hour for me.
Were they waiting, why, to see if you emerged okay or they needed to...
Because I knew that I had to carry on through another tunnel and I had no lights, and obviously it wasn't a good idea to be doing this. So basically, they had this car. It was the smallest car I've ever seen in the world. And we managed to put my kind of 6-foot-long handbike squeezed in the boot, and sort of I held onto it as we went along and held the boot down just so we could carry on a bit.
You're not letting anything stop you, but there are logistical difficulties for people who are in wheelchairs, people who are not able-bodied, you know, they're disabled really by their environment.
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, what's that like sort of traveling when you're not doing these great, you know, adventures, when you're just doing normal traveling?
I must admit, I'll find a way, whatever. I'm very lucky because obviously I can stand up on my crutches, I can use my crutches, and I've usually got those with me. If I am just in my wheelchair, then that's actually more disabling, but not because of my disability, like you say, because of the environment. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, maybe trains can be, maybe buses, maybe London taxis. Quite often taxis will drive past you because they just don't want to pick you up, which is really hard. You have to have a really kind of tough shell, because maybe attitudes haven't all changed.
Yes.
For sure. I like to, you know, with my handbike, I'll do a journey where I'll sometimes involve the train journey or part of or something like that. And you can take a bike on a train. You have to pre-book it, and it's a bit of a faff, but it can be done. So I'll do that. I won't mention that it's a handbike, because I know if I do say that, then they'll probably say, well, we can't do that. But why can't they? Why shouldn't they? It's a bike to me as anyone else's bike is. And most of the time it's fine, but sometimes you do have to kind of, you get to the station and you're battling people that saying that can't go on here, and like, well, it can, I'll show you, I'll make it happen.
So it's surprising how many, even just wandering around London on the tube, you know, I've done it quite a lot with prams, and you suddenly realise that when you can't go up the escalator or the stairs, how few of the stations have
exactly
wheelchair access,
yeah,
or street to platform access.
Definitely. Even sometimes cycle paths can say, you know, they're a cycle path, and then you've got this fantastic sort of slopes, and then you hit a step, and then you think, well, it's totally redundant then, isn't it?
I love it. I spend a lot of time in Spain, and I love some of the wheelchair slopes there, because they're just hilarious. They are like, you know, for sort of 45 degree slopes, like into the sea or something like that. You're thinking, how is anyone like meant to do that? But I mean, especially like, you know, in the UK, we are pretty good with it, but in, you know, there are many countries that aren't, and you know, neither are we brilliant at it here.
Yeah, there's always room for improvement, for sure.
Where have you felt most afraid when you've been travelling? When you're not in a tunnel with no lights, with like lorries bearing down on you?
Oh, where have I felt most afraid? I can't think of anywhere that I felt afraid, to be honest.
Is there anywhere you haven't enjoyed, like as a location?
Well, the first time I went to New York, I say went to New York, I passed through JFK Airport to go to Indianapolis to race, and I had a very bad experience in New York Airport, and that really put me off, which was really silly of me, and so I was like, I don't like you, New York.
What happened?
It was actually an issue with kind of, we had to change flights, and there was an issue with our race chairs, and obviously, so travelling, do you know what, actually, travelling in an airport, being in an airport as someone with a disability is when you feel the most disabled in your life. That is really, really tough.
Very
some countries a lot worse.
Why?
Than
what is it about it?
If you need to have assistance, it's quite often the case that they'll want to park you in this, you know, special bay, whereas you might want to go and enjoy yourself, you know, go to coffee or check out duty free or whatever. And I do tend to kind of fight against that and go and do my own thing anyway. But you're just, you don't always feel so much of a person, you know, you're kind of pushed from pillar to post, and it's not a very nice feeling. Very often people have, you know, talked about being left, very often I've been sort of on an aeroplane, and you've got to wait for your chair, for whatever reason it's not coming, or they don't want to, or whatever, and
they've forgotten.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or they're on strike, whatever it is. And you just want to be like everybody else, because you are. And it can feel very, very different, very segregated. And when you're flying as well, obviously you don't have your chair with you. So again, because I'm just like, well, I'm just going to find my way, I'll kind of like bum shuffle up and down the aeroplane to get to the toilet. But it's not the greatest thing. And many times, you know, it's been, something's been spilt and you're going through wet patches or whatever and you don't know what's on the floor.
And not everyone like can stand
exactly.
like you. So, you know, that must be, I've never even thought about that. You don't have your chair, of course, when you're on the plane. That must be make a lot of people feel really vulnerable.
Definitely, definitely. And because, say, if somebody's sat in like at the aisle seat or something and then, you know, they can't physically get up and you've got people having to climb over you, that's, you know, not very nice. So, yeah, things like that can be tough. And of course, then when we're travelling with wheelchairs, standard wheelchairs tend to quite often can get broken, but also like race chairs and stuff like that. So you've got a lot of equipment. So that's always interesting. You want to get that on flights and all the logistical sort of side of stuff like that. And yeah, and so New York Airport was kind of an experience like that, that there was an issue with the race chairs. I think I had to go back to some area or something, and the customs man who was with me was not very friendly at all, ended up having a bit of a kind of a seizure, and it was just all a very horrible experience. And it really, really put me off New York.
It's funny
really
how
sad.
Things like that happen. But
yeah.
New Yorkers, they do have, you know, they've got a certain attitude.
Yeah.
You know. And people are people the world over, aren't they? But, you know, there are stereotypes for a reason.
Yeah.
It's just that first attitude you get from people is an interesting one.
It was
one
bad of me
sometimes.
Though for Judge, because I went back to New York in 2016 after Rio. I was going for the New York Marathon. I just determined not to let that year kind of end on a bad way, and so I'd planned this marathon just 6 weeks after Rio. And I remember, and I'm not a city person, so you know I like the wilds or the open spaces, but I remember coming off, being picked up from the airport, and it was in the evening, the sun was coming down, and seeing the silhouette over New York. And I was a proper tourist. I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And I absolutely love New York. Oh, I think it's, if not my favourite, my second favourite city in the world.
What's your first favourite?
It's got to be London, I think.
Yeah, it's got to be London.
It's got to be.
And I'm always so proud, we're sitting here in Greenwich, and I'm always so proud when I see the London Marathon on TV, because it looks amazing, you know, in the way they, when people come down from around the Cutty Sark, is always like a great moment. And a marathon, I always think, must be a great way to see a city,
yeah,
to
exactly.
sightsee.
That's what I
think. What other cities have you done marathons in?
Like you say, you know, I'm not really a city person, but I kind of thought, well, I do marathons. That's how I see my cities. I would never go to a city for, you know, a weekend or a trip or something, but I'll do a marathon. And to be fair, you don't really see a lot because, you know, you're putting all your effort in, you're staring at the floor. But if I do have a bit of time afterwards, then I'll have a wander around. So New York, you know, I'll spend the next day and just sort of just push around, and that's lovely. And training in Central Park as well.
Oh, amazing. Oh, I bet that's
brilliant.
You
know, we stay really quite central. And at home, I couldn't go down the high street, and I'm in this tiny little town in Gloucestershire, but actually I can push in my race chair out of on Fifth Avenue and push to the Central Park and train and then push back again in like the middle of the day. It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
also
amazing.
There's no cobbles, you know, there's no like tiny doorways, you know, it's all straight up, straight down, grid.
Everyone
it's
knows
like,
where they're going.
Yeah, exactly. You don't really get lost in New York like
no,
that.
No, no. So whereabouts have been? Seville, that's a lovely one.
Seville's amazing.
Yeah,
oh, I love
really
Seville.
Lovely, really
was it
lovely.
Hot? What time of year was it?
Yeah, it's February,
so
not too hot,
not too bad, yeah.
But it's quite a nice. It's, if I do that one, it's like the first marathon of the year, so it's a nice one to sort of to start with and see how your training is. Yeah.
So you're in the lineup for Tokyo 2020.
No,
you're not. No,
no.
Okay.
So I left the British team. So Hans Cycling was obviously my last team, but I left that to pursue things like last year, like the world record challenge.
And also, you were first. Like, talking about marathons very quickly, you were the first female. Last year, weren't you?
First British female
wheelchair racer in 2019.
Yes,
London Marathon.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was great. And you know, when you're competing at the top level for the games, obviously everything has to be about that. And I was with cycling, so I wouldn't have been able to do my marathons. I wouldn't have been able to do any of my challenges. I wouldn't be able to do any of the charity work that I do or any of the projects and stuff like that. And for me, it was just right that was kind of where I wanted to take things. So, and I still race. I still race at the top level. You know, it's being down here in London now and racing today and again finishing at the Cutty Sark is just incredible. So I kind of feel like I've got the best of both worlds, really. And I will be sad, I think, you know, not being at Tokyo and watching it would be a little bit difficult. But I don't regret, you know, I love what I'm doing now and the opportunities that I can do, but also give to other people as well.
There must have been some dark moments when you first lost your mobility.
Mm.
And when you look back from there to now, do you... It's a difficult question. Would you change anything? I mean, your life is amazing, isn't it? It's turned out fantastic. I mean, obviously, there's still, you know, a lot of hard work that goes into it. And you have the same struggles as many of us do. But, you know, it's a pretty good career, let's say. Would yeah. you change anything?
No, I mean, I had a great life before my strokes, but I have a great life now. It's what you make of it, isn't it? You know, and a lot of people say, oh, is it because of what happened to you is why you are? And I'm like, no, not at all. You know, I've always been, if I want something, I go out and get it. You know, I find a way of making it happen. And that's just your character, isn't it? It doesn't matter, you know, what your background, if that's who you are, that's who you are. So I think if the strokes hadn't happened, I think I'd probably be doing some, oh, obviously, well, I wouldn't have gone to the Games, that's for sure. I always wanted to run a London Marathon, so I'd like to have hoped that I would have run London Marathon. I was doing a bit, started a bit of adventure racing, so again, I hope I'd be pushing on these challenges, just in a slightly different way. You know, I can't run it anymore, I can't ride my old mountain bike, so I just ride a bike a different way, or I race a wheelchair. It's exactly the same as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't see it as about disability, it's about going after the things I want, and finding a way to do it.
Absolutely. I love stories on the podcast. Have you got any sort of standout stories from your travels?
I do like kind of documenting and sharing my travels, so whether that's through film or, you know, just writing about it, and people love to sort of follow along. And although I love to go out on these challenges and adventures kind of solo, but it's nice to kind of share the stories. So there's always something. I remember last year after the challenge, a couple of months after the challenge, I decided I was going to cycle down through France. I always wanted to. My mum lives in southwest France, so I always wanted to kind of do that route. So I think I took a train with my bike down to Southampton and then cycled over to Portsmouth, got on the ferry overnight, and then cycled off the ferry, and it was fantastic, you know, to do that. But I just wanted, after the Hand Cycle Britain challenge, of having that sort of structure and having that support team that I built around me and everything, which was fantastic, and that's what I wanted to do for that. But I wanted to just strip it back and be about the adventure again, and I didn't want to have time schedules or anything like that. I didn't want to have to answer to anybody. And a few people had said, oh, let me know, I'll come with you. But, you know, I just wanted to go. I didn't want to have a plan. I just wanted to ride. And I had my sort of paper map, my road atlas that I'd pulled out and taken that with me. And I didn't plan where I was, even didn't plan how far I was going to ride. I didn't plan where I was going to stop. And I love that. And I rode sort of similar distances, so 100 miles a day with all my kit as well. And I just got to a point in the evening that, well, I need somewhere to stay. And I'd just like knock on doors and say, my like worst friend, you know, have you got any rooms? And somebody would like signpost me. And it was amazing, that feeling, just, you know, just people, isn't it? People, human kindness. They knew of somewhere. They knew if they couldn't help me, then someone else could help me. Or just turning up somewhere and saying, is there anywhere I can get some food? No, but if you try, go to this place, they'll make you food. And you go in there and you have no idea what they're going to feed you or how much any of it costs or anything. And you just get given these bowls of all sorts of stuff. And, you know, that's in France, just across the waters. But it almost felt kind of a million miles away, and it was such the pure kind of adventure again. It was incredible.
Do you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the proper old travellers. It reminds me of Hemingway or even Van Gogh, you know, banging on doors in Provence, wasn't he? Or in Arles. You know, all that traditional, you know, I'm just going to set out with a backpack or with my paintings or with my bike.
Yeah, my violin or whatever.
Yeah, violin, exactly, yeah. It really reminds me of that, and it's really nice to see that people are actually still doing that.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was real France. I didn't want to stay in any kind of the chains or anything like that. One of them down in the Loire Valley, which I hadn't cycled before, which was an incredible place, was this kind of basically like a castle. It had like a moat and a drawbridge and everything, and it was amazing. And you know, get the stories of some of the people that live there and what goes on in the villages, and the real small kind of villages, again, you wouldn't probably pass through, you wouldn't know about. Yeah, it was really great memories, that
one. Sounds amazing. Mm. Well, I'm going to ask you my last question, and my last question is always about music, because I often think that music and travel go hand in hand for many people. If you had to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time of travel, what is that song and what does it remind you of?
There's always so much. I think what's memorable for me was on my Hand Cycle Britain World Record Challenge, I set up a playlist because I knew there would be times when I'd be really struggling. And like you say, music is so important. It's so uplifting. So I kind of put on this playlist, and I said to my friends and my family and anyone, you know, add songs to it that you will remind me of them, or vice versa, or I think might help me. So I never knew what was coming next. And I think the songs I perhaps thought would be my go-to songs weren't always. And there was one song which just seemed to just be the right song that either it came on or I just sing it anyway, from The Lion King. And it was a song, I Just Can't Wait to Be King. Oh. And I don't know what about it, but it was so uplifting. And that was the one that got me through the real tough time. So every time I listen to it now, I'm like, yes.
That's brilliant. If I ever go in the car, somewhere in the car, my kids love to play that.
Yeah.
So, I like the African one. I forgot what it's called, but it's so, it's just uplifting anyway.
It really is.
Who put that on for you and why?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure even who put it on. No idea.
You need to find out. But I can imagine how when you need to draw on your reserves, yes. You know, that's actually really happy.
Yeah. You know, there was another one, which was funny, that I heard was Show Me the Way to Amarillo.
Yeah.
And again, really jovial. And funny enough, that was a song they played before we started our half marathon today. So straight away, I was back in that place.
Really? By pure coincidence?
Yes, exactly.
That's amazing. Oh, what a great coincidence. I love it.
So not the songs I would think at all. Not the songs I would choose, but...
Yeah, well, that's what I love about this question, is it's never like your favourite song in the whole world. It's always something often embarrassing for people. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure you'll agree that Mel is pretty inspiring, and I cannot wait to see what she does next. Thank you so much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. If you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on whatever podcast app you're using. See you soon.